Design ideas went back and forth, and the one finally chosen and executed included a human skull, which was perched on top of the sign itself. By the next day, all the Korean chogi bearers had disappeared. Captain Mikely went out to find them. The laborers were well down the road to the south by the time he caught up. When he asked why they'd left, they replied it was because of the sign with the skull. They said they just couldn't work for people who had so little regard for human beings as to do something like that. Mikely had to promise he'd have the skull removed and that it and its body would receive a decent burial before they said they'd come back. All of us may have become jaded enough to think the sign was a real masterpiece, but to the poor Koreans, our attitude was simply barbaric. But the chogi bearers did come back, and the 15 with me now just smiled and strained and trudged along as we stumbled around in no man's land looking for easy company. We heard movement. I hid the noise-carrying party in a draw and went off with one of the guys to have a look-see. M1's at the ready. Within moments, we made contact with an element of easy company on their way back from a patrol. The chance encounter scared the hell out of them and us, but at least they were able to point the way to the company's positions. It was about 0400 when I finally got to the mud house that served as the company CP. I sat down, then stretched out on the porch outside, and the next thing I knew, gallant Phil Gilchrist was waking me up. Now he was running easy, and as it turned out, he was the one responsible for my not returning to George. He'd been called by Cork a few days before regarding the commission he'd recommended me for months ago. "If you think so much of Hackworth, you can have him," the battalion CO had said, and the next day I'd gotten the word to report to division. Having Gilchrist as my CO certainly relieved some of my disappointment over being yanked out of George. Ironically, this ideal situation lasted a grand total of 4 days. On the 10th of May, Lieutenant Del Evans, who'd commanded Easy until he got hit on Jake Abel, returned to resume his command. Gilchrist assigned me to 3rd Platoon. I was lucky. My platoon sergeant was a damn good NCO, a DSC winner named Crawford, and the squad leaders, Marvin Hardberger, Stephen Stransley, John Whitey Snyder, and Bobby Stokes were all pros too. It wasn't too common to have a top company skipper and 5 Crackerjack NCOs. Not a bad start, I thought, except that during the first couple of days these bad hombres of Easy tried to run me, or at least scare me, out of town. I didn't tell them I'd come from George, and neither did Gilchrist. I'd scrounged a new set of fatigues at division, and with my shiny second lieutenant's bar I looked like a brand new replacement officer fresh off the boat. So I played out the new guy role, and the war stories of the thirsty third, bloodthirsty that is, they said, came hot and heavy. Desiderio and Easy up north in November when the man got the big one the hard way. Millette and Easy and the February bayonet attack. On 7 February, the day after I got hit, Louis Millette, then CO of Easy, led his men in a bayonet charge that Army historian S.L.A. Marshall deemed the most effective bayonet attack in the history of the U.S. Army. With all the attendant publicity and Marshall's gifted hand writing the commendation, Millette ended up getting the Medal of Honor. But a number of George's guys who'd witnessed the assault thought that, as actions go, it was remarkably oversold. On the other hand, G Company always resented Easy's glamour puss reputation. George quietly prided itself on being steady and solid instead. There were countless war stories, from the bowling alley at Taegu to the Yalu and back, all concerning the trials, tribulations, and heroics of Easy. It was small wonder that any other units were needed in Korea at all, judging from Easy's own accounts of their derring do. But I enjoyed the little game. It gave me time to take the measure of my new outfit, and I was pleased with what I found. They were a spirited, proud company, and besides, most of their stories, to some degree anyway, were true. A day or so later, we moved into a blocking position and tied in with G Company. As soon as I got my platoon busy digging, I paid a visit to Mighty George, which I'd left 5 days before. It was like a homecoming, with bear hugs, slaps on the back, hoots and hollering, and exaggerated salutes. "Come see me after you get your shit squared away," I told them. "We're just down the line." And they did. The whole platoon dropped in at my CP, so happy that one of theirs had made it. One of theirs was a lieutenant. None of them called me sir, just Hack, and a very put-on Hack at that. Now it was the third of E who had to listen to overblown war stories, all about their green second balloon, no less. Man, he got us in deep shit there, the George guys were saying. Hell, he's the baddest guy in the valley. You guys in Old Easy Company might just have to get off your asses now that you got Hack here. The George boys' visit sent my stock up 100% with the new platoon. They stopped looking at me under invisible microscopes, and it was total acceptance all around. Now, I thought, we can get on with the business at hand. Two up and one back. Feed 'em hots and keep 'em in clean socks. That's about all you've got to know to make it in the infantry, drawled Platoon Sergeant Crawford as we moved up a few days later with George and Fox online and Easy in Battalion Reserve. We were married up with a platoon each of tanks and quad 50 half-tracks. Our job was to be a counterattack task force in case the Chinks broke through the front line. Every day we rehearsed various counterattack plans. During these maneuvers, I had the opportunity to have a good look at 3rd Platoon, and there was no question that I'd inherited a strong, solid outfit that knew what it was doing. The platoon was full of characters, too, like PFC Red Smalling, a freckle-faced kid and brilliant combat soldier from Arkansas who'd walk up and down the line at night making sure the guys on guard were all awake. If one wasn't, Smalling would hold his .45 against the side of the transgressor's head and fire off a round. And as if that wasn't enough to wake the kid up and teach him a lesson, the next day Red would follow him to chow and beat the shit out of him, with the first sergeant making sure the fight wasn't broken up until Red had done a good job. This particular routine was explained to me by weapons squad leader Bobby Stokes, who also introduced me to the machine gun duo of John Lipka and Richard Sovereign, two gunners who knew their weapons as well as a guy knows every curve of the body of his first great love. They practiced night and day, and had down pat a shave and a haircut two bits duet, which they'd play on their machine guns during enemy attacks so Bobby would know their positions hadn't been overrun. It was a brilliant idea, and it worked. There were also some great characters among the officer corps in our heaven-like reserve. The character of characters was one Lieutenant Milo David Rowell, a West Pointer, class of 1950, and commander of the track platoon co-locating with us. Milo was from a wealthy California family and was the heir apparent to the family fortune. We were all less than impressed. We basically considered Milo an outsider. He wasn't infantry for openers, and all of Easy's officers thought he was a pampered prude. And though we'd never say so to his face, we managed to let him know how we felt by ganging up on him when the officers got together to play hearts. The way we did it was by making sure Milo got the Queen of Spades and every single heart, except one. We'd set it up in such a way that he thought he was going to shoot the moon. He'd get all excited, and then he'd lose with 25 big points. All of us took almost sadistic pleasure in this, because then Milo would throw tantrums. We inferior infantry morons were ganging up on him. Not fair. Not cricket. One night, after he got his usual shaft, he blew up. He threw down his cards, jumped up from the makeshift table, and yelled, "You guys are a bunch of cheaters. I'm never playing with you again." He stormed away, never to return. I think we'd been playing for a penny a pot. The funny thing about this was that we'd really been living the good life during our reserve duty. The work wasn't hard. There was plenty of time for laying back in the warm spring sun. We lived in liberated Korean huts, and we were eating the Army's gourmet food line. Beautiful, hot A rations. Milo was so pissed off that he moved his platoon out of our cozy village and lagered them in an open field. He wouldn't even let his guys continue to eat with us. So they slept under ponchos and ate sea rations while their offended leader fumed. We couldn't help but laugh, despite our feeling sorry for the poor folks in Milo's command. Soon our combined team, designated Task Force Evans, after Dale Evans, our company commander, was ordered to pass through the front and probe a series of small Chink-occupied hills in preparation for a UN-limited offensive, which was jumping off the next day. We breezed out, riding the backs of tanks. When we got close to the hills, the infantry dismounted and deployed in a line of skirmishers. "Mines! Mines!" came a sudden urgent cry. We froze. A quick recon revealed my platoon was in the middle of an American AP minefield full of bouncing Betty types, for infantry the worst in the inventory. We carefully reorganized at a respectful distance behind the tanks, and while the Chinese watched us from the hills, well outside effective rifle range, the tanks proceeded to lead us through the field, blasting lanes with their tracks. Meanwhile, the enemy started lobbing a few mortar rounds, but never got close. One advantage the Americans always had over the communists in Korea, and thank God, because they'd have eaten us alive, was that the Reds could never quickly and effectively adjust their indirect fires, mortar and artillery, nor, with their bad camo, easily coordinate fire support. Once out of the minefield, we started maneuvering up the ridgeline. The tanks and tracks supported our attack with overhead fire from the valley floor. It was standard procedure, attacking a hill under an umbrella of fire, except that after a while we were getting rained on. The tracks' quad 50s were chewing up the ground with long bursts right into my people. I screamed on the radio, "Shut it off, shut it off, you're firing right on top of us." But the slugs kept coming. I grabbed the air panel my RTO dragged behind his radio and started waving holy hell out of it. This long, brightly colored panel would show a blind man our forward edge. The quad 50 fire lifted. Miraculously, we had no casualties. First U.S. mines, now U.S. fire. Who needs an enemy? I thought. Then I remembered who commanded the tracks, and though I did know he hadn't done it purposely, for a fleeting moment I wondered if that friendly fire hadn't just been Milo Rowell's trump card. From the map, and from the valley floor too, the ridge had looked as if it ran to the top of the objective assigned to me by C.O. Del Evans. But about 400 yards from the top of the hill, we found that it was a military crest. To continue the attack, we'd have to move across a long pool table-like shelf and then come back up. There was no cover, no concealment, no avenue of approach. It would have been a picket's charge, no more healthy for infantrymen in Korea 1951 than it was at Gettysburg, 1863. I held up the guys and called Dell with the lowdown. He switched the main attack to 2nd Platoon, commanded by a former NYPD cop and recalled World War II vet, 1st Lieutenant Jim Lynch, which was coming up another finger. Our job would now be to support their assault by rifle and machine gun fire. We'd been pinched out of the assault, and for the third of easy, it was a lucky, lucky case of being in the wrong place at the right time. 2nd Platoon did not have an easy road. The Chinks were solidly dug in and were not about to be shoved off their hill. The first part of the mission, to determine the enemy's disposition, was accomplished the minute we locked horns. The second part of the mission, to inflict maximum casualties on the enemy, was also accomplished, all guns and weapons blazing within the company and supported by tank, quad 50, artillery, and Corsair-delivered bombs and napalm. Still, the assault force took casualties. One trooper was blown down the hill and rolled into the pool table in front of my platoon. He lay in the open, right under the Chinks' guns. Brave Corporal Victor Cazares from my platoon, acting on his own, quickly stripped his gear and took off like a shot. He grabbed the guy as though he were a bag of potatoes and charged back through a hail of enemy fire to the safety of our hill's reverse slope. Our doc patched the kid up, and he lived. Cazares was later awarded the Silver Star for his act of unselfish gallantry. Still, his feat could have backfired. He could have been hit, and then two disabled troopers would have lain exposed on the open fire-swept crest until another brave soldier rushed to the rescue and got hit himself. I'd seen and heard about it a million times. A leader has a difficult time preventing such waste. The problem is simply that if enemy fire can cut down one man, the same fire can cut down 100. In a hot firefight, a rifle platoon can take 10 casualties before you can cry medic, and if you multiply by 10 the one rifleman who falls out to look after his buddy, suddenly you've lost the guts of the platoon's firepower. So a leader has to be hard-nosed. He must remember his mission comes first, and only then the welfare of his men. If a guy stubbed his toe 3 feet from a cobra, he wouldn't let his buddy sit down, take off the guy's boot, and assess the damage, especially when a tiger is lurking just behind the snake. A leader cannot give the enemy the initiative by allowing his unit to become ineffective as a result of care for the wounded becoming first priority. "Keep your weapon downrange and don't play medic," was my standing operating procedure, SOP, and I tried my damnedest to enforce it. Any other course carried not only the risk of failure to accomplish the mission, but also the loss of a hell of a lot more men than necessary. The sun was going down. We were supposed to be home before dark, and having accomplished his mission, Del Evans sent word to break off. 3rd Platoon provided covering fire while the 2nd and 1st broke contact, but the chink fire was still so hot that 2nd Platoon's dead could not be gotten out without a still greater cost in lives. Del wisely decided to continue our withdrawal as planned. We'd pick up our KIA in the morning. Early the next day, a Turk unit attached to the 25th Division secured the hill as part of the offensive, and I drew the task of recovering our dead. When we got up there, the Turks had completed mopping up and were now lazing around and smoking in the sun. Great fighters, the Turks. Mean, loud, and awesome-looking. Damn near impossible to like. But the kind of soldiers you were generally glad to have on your flank. Interestingly, the Turks felt the same way about the Wolfhounds. According to F.O. Alan Bell, who worked with them for a while, the 27th was the only unit the Turks even admitted existed. I found the Turk commander, and he took me to our dead, 4 bodies stacked up, neatly wrapped in ponchos. Then he said, "You Americans no can take hill. Turks take hill. We walk up. Chinese say, 'Ah, Turks come. We run away. We afraid of Turks. Everybody afraid of Turks.'" Now, as individual soldiers, the Turks were great, but the reason the chinks were even on that hill was that the Turks had lost it to them a few days before. Furthermore, our mission had not been to take the hill in the first place. On top of that, the only reason the Chinese defenders were easy pickings when the Turks took off in the attack was that Easy had blown the shit out of that hill. We'd reduced the position to a pile of rubble the day before. But tell that to the Turks. Tell that to this puffed-up dude with the huge mustache. It really wasn't worth the effort. So I just took the broken English shit he laid on my unit and hauled ass and bypassed, as it were, the fight to which my protests eventually would have led. The second phase of the Chinese spring offensive was petering out. Now it was the UN forces' turn to attack north. Happily, the Wolfhound's second bat was given a break from the fighting. We went into Corps Reserve at Weijianbu. There, a tent became the officers' club, and a few nights later, Colonel Cork summoned an officers' beer call, my first of such social outings since I'd been commissioned. In heart and soul, I was still an NCO. After only 2 weeks wearing a bar, not much more could be expected. So I guess it was only natural for me to be uncomfortable, socially speaking, around officers. For the Maine, we came from different worlds. I didn't know a dessert spoon from a soup spoon, and because I didn't have an education, I doubt I even knew the difference between a noun and a verb. When one of my first officer efficiency reports, OER or ER, stated that I was quiet and unassuming, the raider had been dead right, but only because I was too afraid to open my mouth. So at Cork's party, besides having a few beers and bullshitting with Del Evans and Phil Gilchrist, who was now Michaelie's assistant in the Battalion S3 shop, I kept quiet and watched. The whole thing wasn't my scene. Parties never were. My conclusion at this one was that officers' parties were the same as NCOs, except that I'd rather be raising hell with the non-coms than playing out this officer and gentleman game. I was about to slip out and return to my platoon when the new Battalion XO called out, "Hackworth, get the colonel a beer." "The colonel can get his own beer," I replied. It was an immediate reaction, like ducking when someone yells, "Fire in the hole!" I didn't think I'd said it in a loud voice, but it seemed as though everybody in the tent had heard, and now they were waiting for the other shoe to drop, in the most deafening silence I'd ever known. Then quick-thinking Del Evans pulled my ass out of a big crack. He stood up and said, "No, no, Major, not Hackworth. It's Lieutenant Johnson from H Company. He's the junior lieutenant. He was commissioned a week after Hackworth. Johnson, get the colonel a beer." And Johnson, who'd been an NCO for a long time, but unlike me, knew how to move and groove in these circles, jumped up with a big smile on his ruddy Irish face and got the colonel his beer. Del took me aside. "Hack, It's Colonel Cork's policy that the junior officer act as Mr. Vice. It's an old officer custom. Goes back to the British Army. I thought we kicked their ass in 1778, I retorted. I ain't getting no beer for no man, Del, I said, because that's where I was coming from. Always had and always would. Del put his arm around me. Come on, I'll walk you back to your platoon. I'm going to have to teach you some social graces, Hack, he said in his rich Arkansas twang, or start keeping you in a cage. Lieutenant Del Evans was one officer I really liked. He was a small, slight guy, a paratrooper, and a very brave and distinguished soldier. He'd already won a Silver Star and was in for the DSC for an action in February when he'd been the only man of a 7-man volunteer patrol to reach an objective still in enemy hands. Firing his carbine on full automatic, he'd stormed the hill under some serious automatic weapons fire and a sky full of grenades until he'd reached an occupied chink hole. Only then did he find out he was out of ammo, so he jumped into the hole, swinging his carbine like a baseball bat. The two defenders naturally fought back, and after the carbine stock shattered, Del grabbed the enemy's own potato masher grenades and beat the two Chinese unconscious with them. About that time, he saw 25 or 30 enemy soldiers coming up the hill toward him. Right away, he told me later, I decided if I were going to survive, I'd better learn how to use their grenades. He did, and after he threw about 3, the Chinese reinforcements bugged out. Del gave the two chinks in his hole one more bash with the potato masher, set a grenade between them, pulled the cord, and hauled ass out of the hole. People who watched the incident said he flew out like a bird. The net result of Del's single-handed action was the breakup of a serious counterattack that threatened both the men of his patrol and all of Easy Company. When it was over, he was so shook up over what might have happened that he began to stutter and couldn't stop for 3 days. A funny sidebar to the story was that this incident occurred just 10 days after Easy Company's bayonet charge, and despite Del's gallantry, there was much talk about why he hadn't used his bayonet to finish off the defenders. Old soldier Colonel Murch, who was still the battalion CO at the time, even brought the subject up in a note he sent Del along with a bottle of bourbon and a new M2 carbine. The note was attached to the bayonet, and it read, "This carbine and attached bayonet is a token of my appreciation for your today's tremendous act of valor. However, you are reminded that the next time you are expected to use the bayonet, or you will be expected to sign a statement of charges for the misuse of government property." In a word, Del was just a stud of the first order. Besides that, he was a brilliant gambler, much better than I was, and through shared combat and a lot of money won and lost, he'd become not only my idea of a fine combat officer, but also a most respected teacher and friend. One day soon after the officers' club affair, Del had a visitor to our reserve camp at Weijanbu, an ROTC buddy from college days by the name of Lieutenant Lloyd Leslie Scooter Burke. Scooter Burke did not look like a big war hero. He was of small build with metal-rimmed glasses. He was Clark Kent, not Superman. But by May 1951, he was well on his way to become a legend in his own time. He'd already won a Bronze Star, Silver Star, and in November of 50, the DSC for almost single-handedly stopping a large Chinese force from destroying his first Cav unit. By the time he'd leave Korea in November 1951, he would earn 3 Purple Hearts and the Medal of Honor, too. The latter as Company XO, just about to rotate home, when he heard his battalion was in deep shit on the line and led about 35 men left in his company in a final attack, catching live chink grenades and tossing them back on the enemy, killing or capturing about 100 Chinese, and generally playing Audie Murphy on his way to successfully securing the battalion objective. Scooter was a great warrior indeed, but he was also a great guy. He loved poker and played the game with the same daring as he led his troops, but probably the most memorable game that occurred during his visit was one he, Del, and I missed. Fortunately, I don't know where those two were, but I'd taken my men on some night training, and about midnight, when we were hiking back to the battalion assembly area, we heard Bedcheck Charlie making his nightly rounds. Putt, putt, putt. His little biplane, said to be World War I vintage, sounded like a one-stroke lawnmower. The battalion area was far behind the light line, so it was lit up like a circus, a perfect target for the Chinese Red Baron. Down below, the battalion doc and some staff officers were in the middle of a poker game. From our position on the high ground, we saw Charlie start dropping 120mm mortar shells all over the area, one after the other. Even as the mortar bombs exploded all around them, the poker players refused to budge. They held fast, and while 3rd Platoon remained riveted to our ringside seats, Bedcheck Charlie blew up the game. The next night, Dell, Scooter, Captain Eugene Snedeker, CO of H Company, and a couple of other guys and I decided to re-liberate recently liberated Seoul. We jumped into Dell's Jeep and drove down the road. The first stop in our quest for excitement was the 5th Air Force Officers Club. The place was dim and garish inside, but plush compared to where we'd come from. We were wearing our Sunday best field gear, and it got us a lot of heavy looks from the Wild Blue Yonder gang in their Class A's. They acted as if we were savages invading their country, and it pissed us off. These flyboys had the world by the ass while we lived like rats in the field, yet they resented us being in their club. Screw 'em, we thought, and sat down anyway. The chips on our shoulders grew larger by the drink. We became more antagonistic, more obnoxious, more profane. There were a number of complaints about our conduct, and the more complaints, the grosser and badder we got. Before long, the club officer, a big fat major, came over. "You people are not authorized. You're in the wrong uniform, and your conduct is unbecoming to officers." Scooter, who was the baddest of us all, grabbed him. He put a 45 against the major's belly and looked at Dell. "Say the word, and I'll blow him away." Dell gently convinced him that greasing this guy would ruin our party, so Scooter just pushed the petrified pilot away, and we left. We jumped into our Jeep and headed home, taking pot shots at passing street lamps just to entertain ourselves. An MP Jeep gave chase. We were driving in a blackout zone with our headlights on. "Turn those lights off," we heard. Paratrooper Gene Snedeker whipped out his 45 and shot a hole through the instrument panel of our Jeep. Somehow that kind of sobered us up, and we started concentrating on avoiding the MPs until we successfully cruised into the reserve area and crashed into our beds. Soon Scooter went back to the cav, reputation intact. The next little Weijanbu escapade Dell and I were involved in did little to enhance ours. 5 South Korean policemen had, for some unknown reason, beaten up Big Stoop, Easy Company's #1 chogi boy. They'd really done a number on the kid, hanging him upside down from a tree and beating him with their rifle butts. Dell was outraged, and rightfully so. I was among the 5 volunteers who, in accordance with Dell's wishes, put the cops in the same condition as Big Stoop, or worse. This second incident ended up in a CID inquiry. And while the 5 vigilantes got off scot-free, the thing cost Dell dearly. Every time his name came up for a battlefield promotion, it would be crossed out. The lieutenant had shown poor judgment and should have known better. Dell resigned himself to his fate, looking at the events as a lesson for me in the use of power and how it can be abused. I personally believed in the eye-for-an-eye justice we dished out to those cops who'd abused their power, but was sorry that it cost Dell his tracks. He was only 22 years old, but he damn well deserved them. By the end of May, UN forces in the East were really giving the enemy a run for their money, and now the 25th Division was ready to put the squeeze on the Chinese from the other side. The Wolfhound and Cacti regiments were to lead this assault from the west, jumping through the Deuce 4 to attack into the Kumwa Valley. The day before the operation, 31 May, our unit was trucked from Weijanbu down a dry creek bed which was to serve as our main road. Easy Company's assembly area was a ridge running down behind the front line with the company CP located at the bottom. It was payday, traditionally the peacetime army's day off, that wonderful lazy day once a month when you put aside soldiering for the roll of the dice and the snap of the cards. We were still in reserve, which was as close to peacetime as anything in a war zone, so we whiled away the hours pretending we were in Las Vegas. I'd learned to play poker in Trieste, the same place I'd learned the basics of just about everything. I don't know whether I'd read it in a book or seen it in a film, but at some stage early in life, I'd concluded that great warriors were usually great poker players. It made sense, too, because in many ways, the skills required in poker are the same ones you need on the battlefield. Boldness, a cool head, and the ability to bluff. So it was only natural for me to feel compelled to be the best poker player on the block. In Italy, on payday, or the day the eagle shits, we got paid early in the morning by the officers who'd then go away for the day. The company area would then become our own gambling casino, a recreation room, a makeshift Las Vegas devoted to blackjack, craps, and poker. NCOs and enlisted personnel could play, but usually by midnight, only 4 or 5 NCOs would be left, the novices having long before been tapped out. After a couple of days, or nights really, more, most all of the company's money would be consolidated further between a couple of guys. These two would play the big winners from the other companies, the money being consolidated even more until finally the big winners of the 3 battalions, each of whom might have $10,000 to play with, would meet at the regimental NCO club for the final playoffs. The next day, it wasn't unusual for news to filter down that some guy had won up to $50,000 the night before. In that poker is very much a science, you can read as much as you like about it, but you really can't be good at it without playing a hell of a lot. I'd started as soon as I got to Italy, and it took all 4 years I was there to really get it down. At first, I'd been limited by finances. Every month, I was sending $37.50 home to my grandmother in the form of a $50 savings bond. And I couldn't play much poker with the 12.5 bucks left over from my pay. Like most guys, I sold my cigarettes on the black market, which brought in a couple of hundred more. It was sufficient to get started with, at least. At first, I'd last about an hour at the table, then 2 or 3. But whenever I got tapped out, I didn't leave. Instead, I'd go to the sharpest guy I saw there, sit down behind him, and watch. There were some great players. Sergeant Neal, who was in charge of the mess hall, and Sergeants English, McElwenny, and Randall Johnson, who knew simply from my hanging around that they were teaching me. Sometimes one of them might even show me his hand, and I could see how he played, what he played, and when. And I would just take the best I could from him. As time passed, I began to stay in the games longer and longer until, by the time I left Trieste in 1950, I was always in the finals and frequently a big winner. My luck hadn't left me in Korea, except when Del Evans was around, and now, waiting to jump off into the Kumwa, I was on a bona fide winning streak. We played all day, and one by one all my opponents fell by the wayside. At nightfall, we continued by the light of our campfire, but by then I'd pretty well cleaned out the gamblers, so we decided it was time to quit. I must have won at least 2 grand. I didn't bother counting it, just stuffed the loot into my fatigue jacket, feeling a bit disappointed that I had nowhere to blow it. Throughout the day, we'd taken light incoming, but nothing close and nothing big. Our platoon CP was in a draw, and since we hadn't taken any incoming in our area, we hadn't bothered digging in. I'd made the platoon dig for sure, but not the CP, and now that it was dark, it seemed pretty pointless to get carried away scratching out a hole since we were jumping off first thing in the morning. The rest of my CP group, the Doc, RTO Lee Livesey, Assistant Platoon Sergeant Whitey Snyder, and Platoon Sergeant Charlie Greer, agreed, so we snapped together our ponchos and made a big lean-to, which we hunkered down under solely to keep out the drizzling rain. Soon after we'd settled in, the Chinese artillery got serious, blasting all over E Company's position. Then our guns got into the act, and the next thing we knew, a big artillery duel was raging between the good guys and the bad guys. The only problem was that our lean-to was right in the middle, getting the overs and shorts from both. For some reason, it didn't bother me. The guys were saying, "Shit, we should dig." And I kept telling them not to worry about it, that we had a great position here in this draw. Natural protection, I said. But then I heard the son of a bitch coming. I could hear the incoming whistle loud and clear in the dark, and it started coming in louder and louder. We flopped onto our bellies and hugged the ground. Greer was next to me. He flung his arm across my back as the incoming round kept screaming. It was going to land right on top of us. I knew it. And it did, right at the edge of the goddamned poncho, with an ear-splitting roar. "Everybody here? Anybody here?" I asked when the dust settled and the ringing stopped. The doc, Lee, and Whitey all said they were okay, and then Greer said, "I'm hit." Greer had just returned from a wound he'd gotten up north. A 50-cal slug had torn through the muscle and tissue of one of his arms, just missing the bone. He had an incredible scar from it, and now the poor guy told me he'd gotten it again, this time in the other arm. The rest of the CP group, in the meantime, were beginning to sit up, checking out all the places where mud, debris, and equipment had slammed against them when the round exploded to see if they'd been wounded. Amazingly, Greer was the only one. I was still prone, waiting for Greer to move his injured arm. When he finally tried, I felt blood and a lot of pain. "Wait a minute," I said. "I think I'm hit, too." At first, we couldn't work out the connection. Then we discovered that Green's arm was nailed to my back. A shard of shrapnel about 8 inches long and half an inch thick had pierced his arm in exactly the same way the bullet had. It had missed the bone, gone the whole way through the muscle and tissue, then out the other side and into my back. If Greer hadn't been such a big guy, if he hadn't had such huge arms, and if he hadn't thrown one of them across me, I would have been dead. But as it was, I was alive and kicking, with a good wound and a kit full of money. As we pried Greer's arm off my back, all I could think was, "Japan, here I come." With great delight, I flipped on my radio and called Dell. "I'm hit, Greer's hit, and Whitey's taking over. How bad are you guys hit?" "I think it's pretty bad. In the back, for me, Greer got hit in the arm. We're going down to the aid station now. I'll see you on the way out." Greer and I started down the draw, hindered by thorny bushes and scrub trees growing on the ridge, as well as by the artillery that was still popping all around us. We got to Dell's CP. He was concerned about our wounds and about losing a platoon leader and platoon sergeant just before jump-off. I took his mind off it. First of all, I reminded him, Whitey had been a World War II combat platoon sergeant, and he could handle the platoon better than Greer and I put together. And second, I was going to Japan, and I was loaded with dough. "So you're not going to get a goddamned cent of it." The thing was, if I hadn't gotten hit, the next big game would have been the playoffs down at company, and Dell would most likely have cleaned me out. I really rubbed it in, but my poker-playing nemesis wasn't even ruffled. He knew there'd be a next time. Just before we left the CP, I gave Dell my treasured German Mauser machine pistol. It was a Chink officer's pistol, a real prize, and I didn't want it to be knocked off by some rear echelon doc as my Waltham watch had been after 6 February. "Look at this, will you?" I asked him. For some reason, it really mattered. The battalion aid station was overflowing with wounded. "Screw this," I thought. "We'll wait in line forever." A litter jeep was parked outside. We piled in, and the jeep slowly rocked its way down the creek bed road. Much heavier Chink artillery was coming in now, fast and furious. Fires blazed in the darkness. American artillery pieces that had taken direct hits. It was a bad scene. Rounds were smacking all around the jeep. And there we were, well outside the battalion area, traveling about 3 miles an hour with the headlights off. I told the driver to flip on his lights and make tracks. "No can do," he said. "We were beyond the light line." I said, "Fuck the light line. We're talking about our asses." He flipped on the lights and we buzzed down the creek bed at a fast clip, leaving all that incoming behind. A few miles down the road, an MP stopped the jeep. "Get those lights off." "Battalion surgeon," I called out. He shot his flashlight at my bar, which I'd pinned onto my steel pot. "Got some critically wounded here. Gotta get them out." "Yes, sir," he said with a smart salute. We tore off. The regimental aid facilities had taken a direct hit. There were wounded everywhere. Some of the medics were in worse shape than their patients. They were brave men, the docs, patching people, ignoring their own wounds. An aid man came along. "Where are you hit?" "The back," I said. "Does it hurt when you breathe?" As a matter of fact, it didn't. But I was glad he asked the question. It was the million-dollar question, which, if I answered correctly, would be my magic ticket to Japan. "Yeah, Doc," I replied, "a lot." A surgeon came up next, had a look, and asked if it hurt when I breathed. I felt really guilty bullshitting this guy, because he looked a lot worse off than I did. He'd gotten it in the back, too. But I kept thinking of the bright lights of Japan and all this dough I had burning a hole in my pocket. Oh, shit, Doc, yes, yes, like daggers every time I breathe. Both Greer and I were evacuated to division clearing. The medics suspected that my left lung was collapsed and a splinter of shrapnel was still in my back. By this time, it was morning, and I was a litter case marked critical. I still hadn't been x-rayed, but again came the million-dollar question. Did it hurt when I breathed? My response, which was getting better all the time, "It's killing me. Doc, do you think I'm going to make it?" got me back to MASH, and from there on to a hospital train back to Pusan. Litters were stacked three high on both sides of the crowded ambulance train. The wounded composed a fair slice of the United Nations forces fighting in Korea, Turks, English, French, Greeks, Aussies, and Yanks. Most were non-critical, leg, arm, and back wounds that didn't require intensive care, which was all for the best because our nurse was a bulldog. No compassion and strictly business. She thumped a needle in my ass and lectured me about staying put, lest the shrapnel splinter lacerate my collapsed lung further. I moaned and groaned and nodded, all the while keeping my eye on the hot crap game that was roaring in the aisle at the foot of my litter. "You must keep on your left side," she barked. "I want into that game," I thought. The minute the Iron Florence Nightingale went on to the next car, I was in, knee-deep. I still had 2 grand of 3rd Platoon's loot, and with that kind of backing, I could almost buy my luck. And I was hot, red hot. On one occasion, I made 7 straight passes. The bucks were rolling in U.S. military payment certificates, MPCs, lira, drachmas, pounds, and francs. My left hand could barely wrap itself around the wad of United Nations funny money I was collecting, as my right hand went on making pass after pass. Just as I lost the dice and faded into the crowd, Florence marched back into our car. I slipped back into my litter and was following orders by the time her sternness came by. Trying to ignore the resentful glares of my fellow gamblers, who'd lost the chance to win back their money, I concentrated on sorting and counting my loot, now close to 4 grand, and daydreaming about Japan. The train pulled into the station at Taejon, delayed for 4 hours, we were told. Walking wounded could visit a nearby Red Cross club, but litter patients had to stay on board. Shit. But then dear Florence was replaced by a laid-back medical corpsman who, not knowing about my lung condition, told me he'd look the other way if you want to stretch your legs, Lieutenant. The Army sergeant who ran the train depot was wearing a wolfhound crest. I hadn't known him. He'd been badly hit, placed on limited duty, and was now a railroad man. "Come over to my place," he offered. "Got a bottle of Daniels there." The guy's place turned out to be a railway car that he'd converted into a plush, at least by an infantryman's standards, mobile apartment. One corner was stacked with loot. "I take what I need from the supply trains and a little extra for swapping," he said. "Sure beats climbing hills and getting shot at." I readily agreed, especially as I looked over the fine body of his little Korean mama-san. The railroad man caught my hungry stare. "She's yours, old buddy." He told her he was going out to check my trains, take care of my friend here. And he left. The girl and I cracked open another bottle of whiskey and hopped into the sack. She wasn't much to look at, but I didn't spend a lot of time looking. There's a thing about combat soldiers and sex. On one hand, it's the most important activity in the world. On the other, it means nothing at all. Sure, sometimes it was a love thing, but most times it was just a good hard screw. You were always horny and never discriminating. You weren't looking for love, you were looking for pussy. Pussy. One word. And no matter who it was or how it was, that's what it came down to in that all-male, ultra-masculine world of the Army. You'd come back from leave, and the first question your buddies would ask was, "Did you get some pussy?" "Yeah, it was great," you'd reply, even if you'd struck out. "Best pussy I've had in a long time." I want some pussy rolled off a soldier's tongue as easily as I want a drink. Getting as much pussy as you could was part of the role. Proving yourself in the cot was as important as proving yourself on the battlefield. Tribal behavior, I guess. The great warrior, the great conqueror of all lands and all broads. Or some deep psychological thing, knowing you might get killed and wanting to plant the old seed before you went. Or maybe it started in Hollywood. Who knows? Who cares? All I know is, we talked about it a hell of a lot more than we got it. But when we got it, it was pretty damn good. "Train's leaving in 20 minutes, old buddy," said the railroad man when he returned to find an exhausted, drunk, but well-screwed trooper. He walked me to the train. I thanked him for his hospitality. "We wolfhounds gotta stick together," he said. "Hope you get to Japan. Take care, you hear?" I'd known the guy for less than a few hours, yet he treated me like a brother. The wolfhounds were a very special fraternity. We said goodbye. I got back on the train, slipped into my litter, and dutifully laid down on my left side to take the pressure off my poor, overworked lung. The third station hospital stuck out like a sore thumb in the Pusan shantytown that surrounded it. What a terrible place for my journey to end. The doc who examined my wound said, "Good news, son. No lung damage whatsoever. You'll be back with your unit in no time." It hit me like a death sentence. No lung damage meant no Japan, no land of the rising sun, no place decent to spend my money. It really was a hell of a blow, and the only compensation was my new officer status, which had me living like a king in semi-private luxury. It was an eye-opener, this difference between the officer and soldier worlds, like a first-class hotel to a Salvation Army flophouse. In the enlisted wards, the rows upon rows of crushed bodies were requirements with numbers, just to provide basic maintenance. Their nurses had to run around like needle-prodding machines. In the officers' wards, the guy's every need was catered to. He was special, and the nurses had time to be human. It was like two different planets. The highlight of my stay, though, was the afternoon I shared my bed with Jennifer Jones, the movie star who was on a USO tour. Sad to say, I was asleep at the time. She sat on my bed, talked to the other guys, and left before I woke up. What a razzing I took from my roommates. Pusan was the asshole of the universe, a drab, dirty war town where the sun didn't shine. The train ticket was open. It was an unstated hospital policy that a returnee could lose himself in the city for a few days. I couldn't stand the place. So I took the next train north, thinking I might hop off and visit my railroad buddy and his girlfriend in Taejon. Before I left, I bought a case of Southern Comfort from a PX sergeant for $50 a bottle. The stuff sold legally for $3, but I didn't care. What else was I going to spend my loot on? At least I could get the boys drunk, and besides, they really bought it with their own dough. Gambling money was easy come, easy go anyway. It didn't have the same value as the stuff you'd sweated for. On the train, I got drunk with the young 187th Airborne squad leader. He had Shirley Temple dimples, which he'd gotten chasing a slug. "Went in one cheek and right out the other," he said. "I was hollering at my squad. Didn't even know I was hit till I tasted blood." We toasted his Rakasan paratroopers, and then we toasted the wolfhounds. We even toasted the Chinese and got so drunk that I slept right through Taejon. The men of the 187th Airborne were the Rakasans, just as the men of the 27th Infantry were wolfhounds. Rakasan is Japanese for parachute. "But goddamn, Hack, it's good to see you, and especially good to sip a little comfort," Del Evans said when I got back to Easy. He was still the skipper, but his days were numbered. It seemed that his promotion papers to captain had been removed from channels as a result of the Weijambu Big Stoop affair, which meant the first guy with tracks to walk into the battalion would probably be sent to Easy to take over the reins. It was a damn shame. I got back my Mauser, and we caught up on events. Dell told me the division had been on the attack since the day after I got hit. Easy had spearheaded the breakthrough and led the way ever since. Now they were in the 14th day of humping over hill and dale in the Kumwa Valley. They'd overrun enough guns and materiel to equip two Chinese divisions, as well as a field hospital. Easy was moving so fast that the new battalion CO, Colonel Cork, had been relieved, ordered Dell to stop so that his flank units could catch up. "To hell with slowing up," Dell had responded. "Let them catch us. We're on the enemy's heels. We have to pursue the advantage now." Finally, the CO agreed. As long as Dell sent patrols back during the night to keep contact with the flank units, a 2-mile ordeal for the men assigned this duty. Dell himself was in for another Silver Star. On about the 5th day of the action, he'd discovered a large enemy force to Easy's rear. At the time, the company's assault elements had been in the middle of some serious hand-to-hand combat, but Dell had successfully disengaged them, gotten his reserve platoon into good blocking positions and heavy artillery fire onto the Chinese, and brought the enemy to their knees. "The boys did good, Hack," Dell said, smiling. But that had been the high point of the whole 2 weeks. Generally, it had been far less than fun. At one stage, Easy outran its supply train, and some of the men had been on the verge of mutiny after 3 days without so much as a sea ration meal. And to top the whole thing off, somehow word had gotten around that Easy was lost somewhere in the valley, so when the guys had reached the hill above their tie-in point with the 89th tank, the tank battalion thought they were enemy and opened fire on them. "Now that'll ruin your whole day for you," Dell laughed. Luckily, no one got hurt. I dropped a bottle of booze into the top kick and gave him 6 more to safeguard until 3rd Platoon went into reserve. Bearing gifts of the remaining 3, I rejoined my unit. Japan or no Japan, it was good to be back. All the old guys gathered at my platoon CP, leaving the replacements to guard the front. We drank down the comfort all at one sitting, and told tales of war and railroad stations until darkness broke up our little reunion. We continued attacking north through the Kumwa Valley. It was bitching terrain, straight up and straight down, with no roads and few trails in our sector. It took 9 hours to pack wounded to battalion, and about the same time to bring up ammo and supplies. It was no fun, with the only redeeming feature being that the Chinese were struggling even more than we were. Enemy resistance was virtually non-existent. Had someone given us the word, we could have marched right on to the Yalu. As it happened, we did get the word, but the message was entirely different from the one we'd expected to hear. In late June, after 1 year's hard fighting, the U.S. 8th Army started digging in deep on some high ground north of the 38th parallel, which we'd recently restored. We built sandbagged bunkers and installed barbed wire barriers with plenty of mines and booby traps. The Chinks were nowhere in sight. If ever there was a time to keep moving, this was it. But the word was stop. There were rumors of peace talks, though, which was good news for everyone. We all shared the hope that we would soon see a ceasefire. All things considered, it was probably for the best that our youthful naivete prevented us from recognizing the enemy's real intention: to fuel the peace flame only to gain time to rebuild its gutted forces. Still, once the heavy fortification work was over, we started enjoying the Sitzkrieg life until someone remembered that, peace talks or no peace talks, there was still a war going on, and the regiment started vigorously patrolling deep into no man's land. One of 3rd Platoon's first missions was to conduct a combat patrol a few miles in front of our position. An air observer had seen Chinese in a bombed-out village. I stripped the platoon down to 3 lean squads and moved out before dawn. By first light, we were set up on a small hill a few hundred yards from the reported sightings. We took the enemy by surprise, killing 15 and capturing 4 with no friendly casualties. There was no question in my mind now that the Chinese were on their last legs. Our opponents in the village were sick and hungry, with little will to fight, and seemed more like rear echelon troops. I sent the POWs back with the squad while the rest of us poked around the valley. We found 2 more Chinamen who looked as if they'd been abandoned by their unit. Both were more dead than alive, too weak even to brush away the flies. We pretended we didn't find them. The squad with the POWs was still an hour from friendly lines when we caught up with it. The men had been slowed down by the wounded prisoners. We had instructions to get home before dark. "Get back as soon as you can," I told them, as the rest of us passed through and hot-footed it back so we could be in our defensive positions by nightfall. Several hours later, the squad joined us. I called company on the field phone. "Where's the old man?" I asked when an unfamiliar voice answered the call. "Lieutenant Evans is checking the line." "Okay, listen, the POWs are here. I'm sending them to your CP." "Don't bother, Lieutenant," replied the voice through the wire. "They've got no intelligence value. Battalion has 7 already from their outfit. Just shoot them."
"No way."
"What do you mean, no way?"
"Just what I said, no fucking way."
"All right, Lieutenant, how do you propose we get them to battalion then?" This joker was looking at the POWs not as a human problem, but as a logistics one. 4 weak and wounded POWs, a 9-hour walk at night over rough terrain to battalion HQ. We'd lose at least 4 rifles as escorts. But it wasn't that simple to me. It wasn't even the issue. These were innocent soldiers, unarmed prisoners, and always in my head was the strong belief, "But for the grace of God, there go I." "Look," I said, "I'm not doing anything until I talk to Lieutenant Evans. He'll figure out something. Meantime, I'll get the prisoners dug in." As I hung up the field phone, I saw one of my guys hanging around the CP door. I didn't know how long he'd been there. He was kind of a weird guy anyway, never said much and always seemed to be brooding over the problems of the world. The funny thing was, when you put this kid in a battle, he was a tiger, a brilliant, brave combat stud. But the minute it got quiet, he'd revert to being resident weirdo. Anyway, he was a good man, and I knew I could count on him to organize the POWs. I gave him the job, and he shuffled out without a change of expression. A short while later, I headed out of the CP to check 3rd Platoon's positions. I saw Soldier Weirdo overseeing the prisoners. He had them digging in for the night, each with his own little foxhole. I went on down the line, and then, out of the blue, I heard gunfire back behind my CP. I ran over to find Soldier Weirdo holding a still-smoking pistol. He'd emptied the magazine into the POWs after he made each one dig his own grave. "They tried to make a break," he explained. We never spoke again. The kid had lost me forever, and within a week I got him transferred out. And I was pissed off at whoever that bastard was at the company CP. He was probably laughing now. I knew why he'd said those guys should be shot, but it didn't make it right. It was not the way to play the game. It was an atrocity. But he and Soldier Weirdo alone would carry the burden of those deaths for the rest of their lives. I didn't blow the whistle. No one blew the whistle. All of us had seen too many atrocities, and what is war anyway but one big, raging atrocity? It was something every doughfoot, regardless of which side he was on, knew to the bottom of his soul. Both sides had killers and sadists, like PFC Charles and George Company, who shot the 2 POWs on 6 February. It wasn't until a month or so after that that I realized he was crazy. We'd been walking down a road when we passed an old South Korean man with a long, flowing beard. Charles had pulled out his Zippo lighter, grabbed the old man, and set fire to his beard. But each side had battlefield pragmatists, too. One of the guys in the platoon summed up the most recent incident in his friend Soldier Weirdo's defense with, "The fuckers would have kicked off before they got to battalion anyway. The kid just shortened their misery." Soon after this event, Del Evans became the battalion intelligence officer, replaced in the company by a mouse named Captain Pearson. Within a week, Pearson, who wasn't even an infantryman, he was artillery, had virtually destroyed the morale of Company E. It seemed impossible, but it was true. "Shave your face, blouse your trousers, wear your helmet and all your equipment," he ordered. Unshaved and stripped down, Easy had spent the previous year achieving one of the finest fighting records of any company in the U.S. Army. It had been awarded several individual presidential unit citations and had been skippered by Medal of Honor winners Reginald Desiderio, awarded posthumously, and Louis Millette, as well as DSC winner Phil Gilchrist for Objective Logan and Del Evans. "An outfit is only as good as its commander." Desiderio, Millette, Gilchrist, and Evans had made Easy the proud, effective unit that it was. And now this little mouse was tearing us apart. Morale and fighting spirit plummeted. "Hope the bastard doesn't get in front of me during an attack. I might slip and blow his head off," was the old-timer's attitude toward the new Easy 6. Fortunately for them and Captain Pearson, the much-rumored rotation program, which eventually would make Korea a 1-year tour, had started in April.
and everyone was too busy adding up his points and keeping abreast of the changing policy to grease the new old man. After 45 straight days on the line, we were relieved. "Hooray! It's back to beers, broads, and the good life," shouted Ace Machine Gunner Sovereign as we loaded trucks and headed south. But the trucks didn't take us to the rear. Little did we know, we were being shifted from the quiet western sector of the Kumwa Valley to the red-hot eastern side. The enemy held the high ground. From the towering slopes of Papasan Hill 1062, the Chinese had commanding views of the entire valley. And as well as having such brilliant observation, the enemy also had plenty of indirect mortar and artillery support. The wolfhounds had jumped out of the frying pan and into the fire. The hardest hit by this reality were the high point rotation guys who had figured they'd never see the front line again. There were no celebrations that day in the land of the morning calm. That evening we conducted a night relief without incident. But when the fog lifted in the morning, we found ourselves looking straight into enemy guns on the higher ground across the valley. Fortunately, 3rd Platoon drew the open right flank, which was the farthest away from both the Chinese and